Hello and welcome to a special bonus episode of the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here, as we do every month now, to talk about classic Doctor Who.
Yes.
We might have to give this, like, monthly show a different name, but because we're going forth. And if any episode solidified that we're doing more of this,
yeah,
it's this fucking one.
Uh-huh.
This month on the show, we are moving ahead to the third Doctor.
We are. John Pertwee himself.
We are talking about the final story of his second season, The Daemons. Or The Demons.
Yeah, depending on how you want to pronounce that thing.
Which the story is not sure how it wants to pronounce
it. Yes, it goes back and forth on it.
We have, in the last 2 months, talked about a first Doctor story, a second Doctor story. The goal of this is that if you have not gone into classic Doctor Who before, one, you should.
Yeah.
And two, each month we're going to pick an episode from a different Doctor and talk about it to help ease you into the show. And Sean, who has seen every episode of Classic Who,
yes,
has been picking them. Sean, other than just it's fucking awesome, why did we pick The Daemons?
Well, the real, actual, true reason is just that I wanted to rewatch it, which is the real, actual, true reason for kind of all of the ones I'm picking. But other than that, it is also my criteria has not necessarily just been, like, pick the best story, although a lot of these stories are, like, some of the best stories from each run. It is also, I want to pick the one that I think exemplifies sort of like the specific traits and characteristics of each era of Doctor Who. So that's why we did like the real historical story of the Aztecs for the first Doctor. We did, you know, the fun, crazy sort of like sci-fi stuff with Tomb of the Cybermen. And for the third Doctor, who has one of the most singular, I think, eras on the show, I picked The Demons because it has... the biggest prerequisite for me in picking a third Doctor story was it had to have the Master in it. We had to do one that had Roger Delgado.
Like, there's lots of good third Doctor stories that don't have the Master,
yeah,
but especially because, like, this year on New Who, we had all the Master stuff, and it is so defining of his era. You've got to start there.
Yes, and I just, and you will talk a bit about how you have gotten into a third Doctor hole, but before you did that, you had never seen a story with Roger Delgado, so that was another side of, like, I wanted to make sure you had that. But I also had to make sure we got an episode that had, you know, the Brigadier, it had Sergeant Benton. This one even has Captain Mike Yates, who is sort of here and there sometimes in the Third Doctor era. But it's got the whole cast, it's a big, crazy adventure. Yes, it has Joe Grant as the companion, who's sort of like the most, you know, Third Doctor companion. She was with him for the longest. And then it's just a big, crazy, fun adventure on Earth with just a lot of ridiculous action and stupid monsters that are great monsters.
It's a very prototypical Third Doctor series in like story in the skeleton of it.
Uh-huh.
But in the execution, it's a very typical Third Doctor story on fucking crack.
And I had kind of forgotten just how action-packed it is. And that's the most appropriate because the Third Doctor is nothing if not a man of action.
Yeah!
Exactly. You know, he's got to use that Venusian karate.
I really, you know... So do you want to talk about how I've been getting into this?
Yeah, let's talk about, that. Because
your story, everyone knows, you've seen all of
it. Yes, I've seen all of it. So that's... Yeah, we've been over that plenty. But you had only seen, like, weird bits and pieces of classic Doctor Who up till now.
I'd seen something from every Doctor.
Yeah.
And most of the Doctors, I'd gotten to the point where I'd seen more than one thing. The third Doctor, though, like... When I went through them all the first time years ago on an old podcast we did, he was the one that made the biggest impression on me. And I went back, like, with the 50th anniversary special, we were going to have a multi-doctor story, so I watched the three Doctors, and I'm like, this John Pertwee guy is awesome. And I'd seen several of his stories, and then you and I were doing this Classic Doctor Who podcast project, and I really wanted to start watching more stories in order. The thing is, with the first and second Doctor, that's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially the second Doctor, because it's like, even with Tomb of the Cybermen, if you want to just pick up and do the next one, you can't.
Yeah, it's only his last season that you can do it for almost all of the stories you can just watch through. But other than that, it's very hard.
And, you know, you could do reconstructions and stuff. I just wanted to be able to, like, easily kind of settle in and watch some stories.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, the Third Doctor era, it's actually very similar kind of to, like, I've been rewatching the Moffat era in preparation for the end of his run. It's the same kind of thing where it was a very, like, fresh start. Where everything kind of gets reset at the beginning. And, I mean, with this one, literally, you're in color for the first time.
Yeah.
And so I just started with Spearhead from Space, which I'd also seen in as one of my favorites, and went on from there. And I've been enjoying it so immensely. I got through his first season, season 7, and I thought, oh, man, you've got Spearhead from Space, Doctor Who and the Silurians, Inferno. It cannot get better than this. And then his next season, season 8, all of the stories have Roger Delgado as the Master.
Yeah.
He is... Just spoil my opinion on this. without even a question the best Doctor Who villain.
Oh, yes.
Like,
yeah.
It's not even a contest, and that's not putting anyone else down. It's just he's in a different league.
Yeah.
And you've got, you know, the entire cast in place. They start to, I think, loosen up and experiment with what a Third Doctor story was. And they're just terrific. And I keep watching these amazing stories. Ones that I'd heard a lot about, like, you know, Inferno. And ones I hadn't heard a lot about, like Colony in Space. But that's also, I think, a map. An unheralded Doctor Who masterpiece, Colony in Space. And, like, these are all great. And I'm like, I am so excited to see the Daemons. Because this is the one Sean picked of all these great stories. I wonder, is it going to, like, disappoint?
Nope.
The Daemons is fucking insane. And I love that the finales for both his first and second seasons are Inferno, which is fucking insane.
Oh, yeah.
And then the Daemons, which is really insane.
Yep.
And it's this whole occult celebration with the Master where the Doctor gets almost burned alive on a maypole. And it's wonderful and weird. And, man, I just... The Third Doctor era is, like, other than... The 12th Doctor run that we're, I guess, still in nearing the end of, I would say easily the best run of Doctor Who I've seen, and I do want to continue it on through the 4th Doctor and see all that, because that's the other, obviously, era that people will say is the best part of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But, it's some of the best sci-fi storytelling I've ever seen. Every story is varying shades of great, I think. And there is something that I think we can talk about with the Daemons, because I think the Daemons leverages this really well, to having a stable supporting cast. And it's not just the Doctor having a couple friends in the TARDIS. It feels like a TV show cast. Like, there are, in that season, 6 regulars. You have the Doctor, the Master, Joe, the Brigadier, Sergeant Benton, and Captain Mike Yates. And they're pretty much all there in every story. Colony in Space is a little different. We still have the Master and Joe and the Doctor and stuff. And there is something about that that's, I think, really interesting that Doctor Who has never really done in a different era. And I think there was also something to, and I think the Daemons is actually a great example of this, being stuck on Earth. It was frustrating for the Doctor, and it was frustrating for Terrence Dix, he'll talk about it, but God, it made them get so creative.
Yeah.
Like, I do think creative limitations sometimes help, and I think they got so creative, and one of those is like, well, fuck, what do we do for the next story? Evil demons in the English countryside. Okay, let's take that to the nth degree.
And they definitely did. So before we dive into the Daemons as a whole, let's back up and like talk more about that Third Doctor era, broadly speaking. Because as you said earlier, there are like this was a fresh start in a way that Doctor Who had not had up to this point. Because that, I mean, the William Hartnell to Patrick Troughton transition literally happens in the middle of a season. I mean, like, what you talk about with, like, what a season was in, like, the first Doctor, the second Doctor era is a little weird. But still, like, it just sort of, like, moved right through that. And here, when the Third Doctor comes on, there was a huge shift in the show in a lot of different ways. One of, like, the most obvious ones, if you're watching them all back to back to back, is that it's in color. But, and then also, obviously, now that Jon Pertwee's playing the Doctor. But there's a lot of other stuff that is also really important to sort of talk about here. And it's one of the first, like, early pivot points that you see, like, Doctor Who becoming more like what we think and understand Doctor Who to be now. Like, if you look at, like, the first and second Doctor era, there's obviously a lot of the stuff is recognizably Doctor Who, but there are the things of, like, the role of the Doctor in a story, the role of companions. That stuff was kind of different back then compared to, like, the modern Doctor Who model, which is like the Doctor is the leading man, he's an action sort of lead character, and then the, you know, the companion is always this sort of like modern contemporary female British character that has a very specific function in most of the plots. And that was something that it took a while for the show to develop to that point, and the Third Doctor era is a big shift more in that direction. So some of the stuff that happened was, it's 1970 now, and so it's a lot of the Third Doctor stories are very psychedelic in ways that are really fun, and the Daemons is a good example of this. It's also very heavily influenced by James Bond, and that's very clear in a lot of ways. In fact, the Daemons actually uses some footage from a James Bond movie.
From Russia with Love.
Yeah, for the explosion of a helicopter, which is amazing. But the other big thing that happened, and to me is maybe the most significant change that happened with the shifting to the Third Doctor that is important in how we talk about this stuff, is that for the first and second Doctor era, the production staff behind the scenes was very transitory. Like, they were on there for like a year at most and then moved on. Like Verity Lambert was basically only there for the first season. Verity Lambert being the woman who created Doctor Who, and she was the producer for the first season. And then she left very quickly. And that was kind of how it was, as they churned through people behind the scenes pretty quickly in classic Doctor Who. So it's hard to look at that first and second Doctor era and like Doctor Who in the 60s and talk about it the way that we talk about modern Doctor Who, which is like, you know, you talk about Russell T. Davis and you talk about Stephen Moffat as showrunners and how they have eras on the show. That's harder for me to do with the first and second Doctor, but it is not hard to do with the third Doctor, because the third Doctor has sort of solidifies these two really important creative positions that define the show going forward, which are positions that generally are held for 3 to 5 years by most of the people that fulfill these positions. And that's the lead producer, which for the third Doctor is Barry Letts, and that's the script editor, which for the third Doctor is Terrence Dix. And both of them serve those roles for the entirety of the third Doctor's run. And Terrence Dix actually was script editor a little bit before the third Doctor came on the scene. And that's, I think, one of the big interesting shifts that happens with the third Doctor, is that Barry Letts in particular, you can feel his sort of like creative energy in the show all the way through the third Doctor's run. I think he's the defining, like him and John Pertwee, obviously, like for like the front facing, like on screen element. But in terms of the behind the scenes, getting the scripts together, doing the casting, all that stuff, that's like Barry Letts driving the show forward and making these top level decisions about having like this largest supporting cast, about like what kinds of stories we're going to tell on Earth, about introducing all these like psychedelic elements and introducing action and stuff. It's a lot of his influence there. And so if you're looking at like the showrunner, that position didn't exist technically back then. It was in the way that like it officially exists now. But that is, Barry Letts was the showrunner for the third Doctor era. And he also happened to be the co-writer of the Demons with another gentleman. I can never remember his name. Robert Sloman, who Barry Letts and Robert Sloman wrote a number of different stories in the third Doctor era together. But and then Barry Letts also was a director on a number of different Third Doctor stories.
And what's their pen name on this? Guy Leopold, right?
Yes.
Guy, yeah.
Yeah, Guy Leopold.
You have a lot of pen names in this era of Doctor Who.
Yes, that goes for it. I think it was partially there was a like sort of element in place of where for there was some like policy with the BBC that they did not want production staff to also write. And I think there were like credits issues with that. So that's why you have a lot of weird pseudonym stuff.
I love this whole explanation because it really is helpful to understand the Third Doctor run, which is, especially I think if you've seen a good amount of First and Second Doctor stories, remarkably consistent. And I don't just mean qualitatively, though it is, but it does feel like the same show story to story, you know, whereas the First and Second Doctor, and sometimes to their credit, it's a wonderful thing about them, but there's a lot of very different flavors of stories
there. Absolutely, yeah, like they move through those styles very quickly.
Yeah, but no, I mean, the Third Doctor run, it feels very modern. And like the Daemons, frankly, it's crazier than you would ever get on Modern Who, but there's a lot of elements of it that you forget you're watching Doctor Who from 1970. It feels like, I mean, there's more action in this than a lot of modern Doctor Who stories, and that's saying something.
Yeah. Another thing that I just thought of, that in case people are just like, this is your first introduction to classic Doctor Who, it is important too, if you don't know and haven't researched the context of why this is all set on Earth and all that stuff.
Right.
Basically, what happens at the end of the Second Doctor's run, at the end of the War Games, which is his last story, is the Doctor contacts the Time Lords, although they have not been called the Time Lords yet still. I think they have now in where we are with the Third Doctor, but at that point, we didn't know what the Time Lords were. Then we still haven't heard Gallifrey. That word has still not been spoken yet. And so then the Second Doctor contacts the Time Lords. We find out about that element of it and that he ran away from them. And because the only way he can solve this problem is by having the Time Lords be involved. But obviously the Doctor stole his TARDIS and ran away from this unnamed home planet. And the Time Lords are still not very happy about that, are not happy about how he goes and interferes with all this stuff.
And they're dicks.
And they're massive fucking pricks. Yes, that is that is very true. So they, they give, great, brilliant, maybe arguably one of, if not the best companion ever, Jamie, has a very sad ending for people who don't know, is that Jamie and then Zoe, the other companion at the time, are put back in their time zones and only remember their first adventure with the Doctor, and the rest of their memories are wiped. So they forget I think that eventually that's like retconned in Big Finish stuff or something. But in the original canonical TV show,
right,
they forget all their adventures with the Doctor. And then as part, as a punishment, they forcibly change the Doctor. Because we still also, regeneration is not a term that is in use yet. So it's funny to think of all the stuff that people understand about like what Doctor Who is and all the terminology. And it took like a decade plus for most of that stuff to actually like be official on the show. So they forcibly change him into Jon Pertwee and dump him onto Earth. And then at the beginning of Spearhead from Space, the TARDIS doors open up on Earth and Jon Pertwee just falls out of it. And it's all in color now.
And we're off to the fucking races.
Exactly.
Just like, let's start with one of the best Doctor Who stories of all time and then see if we can one-up it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great. So yeah, that's, and he's working with UNIT and Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, who had appeared in several Second Doctor stories.
Yeah.
Benton had as well.
Yes.
He's in, I think I'd seen Benton in The Invasion, right?
He's in that one. Yes, he's in The Invasion. I think that's his first story.
I love Sergeant Benton. He's a good guy.
Very good. He has a lot of really good moments in The Demons.
Yeah. He sure does. And yeah, so you have this kind of regular cast around him. The Third Doctor's first season companion was a woman named Liz Shaw, played by Carolyn John.
Yeah.
And I like Liz as a companion.
I think
she's probably a little underserved by the show. Although Inferno, she's fantastic.
Yes.
Because she's mostly not playing Liz Shaw in that one. Or she's playing evil Liz Shaw.
Yes.
And anyway, that's great. That's where you have the Brigadier with an eye patch, and it's wonderful. But then you get to but even like the Liz, like they never quite figured out exactly how to use her on the show. In part because she is introduced as like UNIT's scientist. Like, if it weren't for the Doctor, she would be doing his job. And it's just, like, they never really figured out how to have two... Like, today we would think of Liz almost like a Clara or something, who can really go toe-to-toe with the Doctor, but they didn't really write it that way back then.
Yeah. It's also important to note that while you have this larger supporting cast structure for, like, the companion right. role, this is the first time we're moving to this, like, one companion thing, that for the First Doctor and Second Doctor era, it was basically you always had a group of at least two, if not three, companions altogether.
Doctor Rhode with a posse.
Exactly. And now, so it's like, and it's one of the interesting things about that Third Doctor era is that it sort of smooths that transition by having this larger supporting cast until you get to the Fourth Doctor era, which is mostly just one companion the whole time.
Yep. And then in his second season, season 8, is when you get Joe Grant, Katie Manning, who is in my... always in the running is for my favorite companion.
Sure, yeah.
One of the top for me.
She's very fun.
You know what? I actually think it would be useful. Usually we kind of talk about the characters later in the story.
Okay.
The Third Doctor run is so cast-centric, and I actually think to talk about the Daemons, we have to have some context for the characters.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of these characters.
Okay.
We also talk about the Master, who was introduced this season.
Yes.
And everything Roger Delgado brings to the table. But let's talk about some of these characters. So Joe Grant, really quick, just because we were talking about that, like, why does Joe Grant work as a companion so well? And to me, I mean, it's a couple different things. One, Joe Grant, to me, is the funniest companion. She makes me laugh all the time. And it's not that they give her jokes. It's just that Katie Manning is really funny. I think she's just a naturally funny person. And her interactions with the Doctor, like, it's a really interesting thing. Because you could, on paper, it sounds regressive what they did, which is that the Doctor's companion was too smart, so we gave him a woman who's not a scientist to hang out with. It doesn't play like that to me. It plays like that, like, Joe Grant, no, she is not the genius that, like, Liz Shaw was, but in some ways she is more what the Doctor needed, which is a friend.
Yeah.
And she is, like, just a really good, loyal friend to him, and she has this really unique, youthful look on the world. Like, my favorite recurring companion tick is that Joe Grant will break out and recite 60 psychedelic song lyrics. She does it at the beginning of The Daemons, where she says, "It is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, Doctor." And in The Three Doctors, you have my favorite Doctor Who joke of all time, which is that the Second Doctor is explaining, "I am he, and he is me, and we are all together. Goo 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 choo. I get it, Doctor." Best Doctor Who line ever. And it's just things like that. She's very funny. But I also think, like, she facilitates a lot of interesting storytelling, both with her relationship with the Doctor, in that they're just, it's very father-daughter kind of, you know? And they're very good friends in that way. But also, she is a really interesting active presence in that she kind of, I think, also helps to kind of foster what we would get in a lot of these younger female companions of, she has a certain go-gettedness to go, like, help solve the mystery.
Yeah.
And she's just, she's great. I love Joe Grant.
And she's very, like, it's one of those things of, she feels so 70s. Like, she's so of that, like, early 70s.
Her costumes
era.
Are amazing.
Yeah. I mean, the hair in, for all the characters in the Third Doctor era is just astounding. All the hairstyles, two thumbs up.
She's got this, like, jacket in the Daemons. this like faux, it must be like faux leather kind of thing she's wearing with like these pants that kind of match. It's just an amazing outfit.
Yeah.
She's got the best costumes.
Yeah, she's a lot of fun because also like Katie Manning is an insane person. Like she's just, if you've ever seen an interview with her, she just seems like she's bouncing off the walls in a way that is very appropriate for the Joe Grant character. She lives Joe Grant.
Absolutely. And there's just, you know, the most important thing about any companion-doctor relationship is this thing that I think goes beyond talent. It's not something you can plan for. It's something you just have to let happen organically, and that's chemistry.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I'm watching in my modern Doctor Who rewatch the period where Jenna Coleman is with Matt Smith, and then she's with Peter Capaldi. And Jenna Coleman's a great actress. Matt Smith is a great actor. I don't think they have the kind of chemistry requisite of a great relationship, doctor and companion. And then she's with Peter Capaldi, and like, yes, it snaps yeah. into place. And it's like, this is that, you know, Liz Shaw and the Doctor were interesting together. Joe Grant and the Doctor together are like an all-time team-up.
Yeah.
You know? And I love that.
Yeah, I mean, she's with the show for a long time. She's with them for 3 years.
Three full seasons, yeah.
Yeah, the first year is Liz Shaw, and then the last year is Sarah Jane. That whole middle chunk is all Joe Grant all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and gives the Doctor, like, it's nice that the Third Doctor gets multiple companions, but there is also this one in the middle that's, like, all his. And
yeah, and is the show. One of, like, if I think about, like, the Third Doctor, like, right. Joe Grant is the companion I think of more yeah. than anyone else.
So, what other character? Let's talk about some of the unit figures.
Yes.
Because Joe Grant, of course, her role is, I don't know what job exactly she got with unit. I assume yeah. the Brigadier put an ad out, like, you have to work with a crotchety old man. Who's annoying me.
Because I was hoping that since you just watched this whole season that you would remember how the fuck she gets a job at UNIT, because I actually don't. It's been a long time.
It's really great. In Terror of the Autons, which is a phenomenal story, in the first episode, basically, the Doctor is like, you know, again, trying to repair his TARDIS, which he does a lot in yeah. these seasons. And the Brigadier brings in this like, or no, Joe Grant just comes into the room and starts doing stuff right. for him. And it's a phenomenal first scene because the Doctor like, is just thinks this young girl has come in to annoy him. And she's like, no, I'm your new assistant. He's like, I don't need an assistant because the Third Doctor is a fucking snob.
Yeah.
And anyway, they have this back and forth. And then the Brigadier comes in and says, you do need an assistant, Doctor. Just because Liz Shaw went back to university because she thought you only needed someone to hold your screwdriver, you do need an assistant. It's like this great exchange. And then Joe Grant kind of endears herself to the Doctor by being plucky.
Right. Yeah. But they don't address how someone so utterly unqualified is working for
no.
the United Nations Intelligence Tax Force.
Again, like, the Brigadier and the Brigadier is the next character I'd kind of like yeah. to talk about. And the yeah, Brigadier right. and the Doctor have such this well-defined relationship where they love each other, but they're always bickering.
Yeah.
And I think it's just like the Brigadier was probably annoyed at the Doctor one day, and it's like, he needs an assistant. I really don't care who it is.
Yeah, just like take the top of the pile.
Yeah.
It's like, here you go.
Yep. Like, Joe Grant doesn't even seem to know quite how she landed the job. She's very helpful.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Brigadier.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Brig.
What can you say about Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart other than, here, I'll give a little anecdote.
Okay.
So I've now watched two full seasons of this. I already loved this character, the Brigadier, because if you like throw a dart at a second or third Doctor's story, and you will probably get a Brigadier story.
Yeah, especially like if you're culling like the good ones in particular yeah. from like the whole history of Doctor Who,
yeah.
for which he appears for every Doctor except for the first Doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you will probably find a Brigadier. So I had seen a lot of the Brigadier, always loved him. As I've said before, he is like if you took Graham Chapman from Monty Python playing the general and just had it be a serious dramatic performance, that's yeah. the Brigadier. And Nicholas Courtney is so awesome in it. But I, you know, now I really know the character and his relationship with the Doctor. And I got to that scene in The Wedding of River Song, the modern Doctor Who story.
Oh, yeah.
It's the worst Stephen Moffat episode by a country mile, but it has one scene where Nicholas Courtney had died in real life, and the Doctor calls the retirement home where the Brigadier is and says he wants to go hang out with his friend, and it's like the nurse says, well, he passed away in the night. He, you know, was always talking about you, and every time he had a drink, he always poured an extra scotch hoping you'd come around. And I was tearing up, and my brother, who has not seen Classic, was looking over at me like, what's going on? I'm like, this is fucking tragic.
Yeah.
This is so tragic. And it is because he looms larger kind of than any one companion.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's stuck with the show like all the way through to the Seventh Doctor. I think he doesn't have a Sixth Doctor story other than Big Finish rectified that with one of their audio dramas.
Right.
But like he's there, like Battlefield is one of my favorite Seventh Doctor stories. So that's the one that we watched mm-hmm. Forever ago on an old podcast as my favorite Seventh Doctor story at the time. And yeah, like he has this presence on the show that even when the show was going wayward, like the Fifth Doctor story, Modern Undead, which is where the Brigadier shows up for the Fifth Doctor. Like, he just centers that show again when the show had totally lost itself in a way that's like, Nicholas Courtney and that character have such a power and are so perfect for the show, and particularly that relationship with the Doctor, of where they are in some ways like the complete opposite, and yet they both drive each other so perfectly. If you're talking about like on-screen chemistry, somehow Nicholas Courtney has perfect on-screen chemistry with every single Doctor he played with.
He does, absolutely. But of course, John Pertwee's the one he did it the most with.
Yeah.
Which means they just get to play more shadings, naturally, yeah. You know? And you get these, like, in the Daemons, you don't get a lot of the bickering because they're in a very tense scenario where they have to put aside any differences. But, like, you know, you often get, they will get very mad at each other. Or mostly the Brigadier takes it in stride, and the Doctor is kind of a jerk to him.
Yeah.
But you always get this sense that, like, I think their, like, love and respect for each other runs very deep. Kind of like an old married couple is the way they play it. But it's great. I mean, he lends this spine to the show in this period that I think is invaluable. You know, I joked on the regular podcast that the Third Doctor's greatest enemy wasn't the Master, it wasn't the Daleks, it was bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And it's part of that is represented by the Brigadier. And it's not the Brigadier's fault, but like the Brigadier's the guy who has to take the Doctor's insane ideas and make them like work. And it's actually something in modern UNIT stories, you don't get this because UNIT is just like in awe of the Doctor. And I wish they'd kind of dial that back a little bit.
Yeah.
Because part of the fun of a UNIT story is that they have to work in the real world. And the Doctor knows more than they do, but he doesn't know how to interact with this world. And that's part of the fun of them brushing up against each other.
Yeah. The other element that's so vital for the Brigadier to play, and it's one of the reasons why I think Nicholas Courtney is so vital for the show, is that he can make the most absurd, outlandish, ridiculous fucking plot seem so grounded and real because the Brigadier just approaches every single scenario with this sardonic attitude of like, okay, yep. Like he just, everything he encounters that is would seemingly be beyond your comprehension and would send any other person like basically insane, he's just like, I guess this is how the world is, and just accepts it into his worldview and then moves on from there. And the way he's just able to accept something and move with it, even if it's, again, it's like fucking the Master summoning the devil, basically. He's just like, okay, how do we used to fix it then?
It's why he's the right guy for UNIT.
Exactly.
Because, and you get the feeling, like, maybe if he was in a regular, like, military brigade, he'd be the weird one in the group. But because he's here, it's like he adds normalcy to the craziness.
Yeah.
And no one else could do that job because no one else would have the like intellectual stamina to do these crazy things.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's the wonderful thing about him, of the many wonderful things.
Then on top of that, Nicholas Courtney just also has some of the best like deadpan delivery humor. In particular, there's a couple of really great moments in The Daemons, but I really love early on when like the shit has gone crazy but he doesn't know about it yet, and he's calling from his like hotel room or something to find out like where everybody is, and you only hear his side of the conversation, he just says, "They took my helicopter."
He's great. I mean, I said like it's a dramatic performance, but Nicholas Courtney knows when it's funny.
Yes.
He's in on the joke, and what a great actor and character and everything.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah. And then you have the UNIT supporting cast, like Sergeant Benton and Captain Mike Yates.
Yeah.
Benton, to me, like, you know him better because he's been in more stories and stuff. And he's just, he's always there. He's very much like a mini Brigadier in some ways. And he's just a good, simple guy.
Yeah, I like him. He just, like, I feel like Sergeant Benton's role is, like, he's kind of like the muscle in some ways, which you very much see that in this story. But he also, I think he's able to be more kind of on the Doctor's level and on Joe Grant's level with a lot of things, where the Brigadier has to be above them because he's the commanding officer. And Sergeant Benton kind of gets to go along with them and have fun with them in some ways. And yeah, he's not a like eccentric, crazy character or something. He doesn't get a lot of big Sergeant Benton stories, but he's this nice rock, like steadfast presence in the show.
It's like any good TV cast. You're happy when your favorite characters show up. And Benton is one of them, you know?
Yeah.
And Captain Mike Yates, he's introduced along with Joe Grant and the Master in Terror of the Autons.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's basically kind of like a male counterpoint to Joe Grant in that he's the younger, like, UNIT figure. And I don't know him as well yet, and I know he has some big story stuff, like, later in the run.
Yeah, near the end. He's got some stuff.
But he's an interesting character, too. I like him as kind of the more, like, vanilla white guy, you know, yeah. kind of standard soldier character.
I mean, he's very much, he feels like this sort of like middle, like upper middle class, because he's a captain, so he's like technically an officer, but he's so young that it feels like he hasn't really, he doesn't have like the wealth of experience, whereas like Sergeant Benton feels like, Sergeant Benton's been through the shit. We know he's been through the shit because we've watched the invasion. He's been through the shit, let me tell you. But yeah.
Sergeant Benton wasn't always so accepting of everything.
Exactly, yeah. But yeah. So it's like Sergeant Benton's sort of like been there and like worked up to be a sergeant, and then like it feels like, you know, not anything against Captain Mike Yates, but it feels like he more is just like, you know, he grew up and went to like some academy or something that like allowed him to just become an officer, and then he joined unit.
And it always feels, and I did look this up, and it was a plan at some point, like they were always like, you know, flirting with Mike Yates and Joe Grant getting romantic.
Yeah.
And it never happens.
No, it doesn't.
But it always feels like there's something there that they never explore.
Yeah, like, I had kind of forgotten about that until I was watching The Demons again. I was like, oh, wait, right, this was totally going to be a thing, and then they just decided not to do it, even though I think it would have been a slightly more graceful way to transition Joe Grant out than the weird classic Doctor Who thing of introduce a male character in the middle of a story that then, at the end of the story, the companion's like, well, I fell in love with this dude, so I'm just going to stay here. It's like, what? That was fast. All of you people, that was fast. My own granddaughter.
All right, Roger Delgado.
Yes,
the master. And this will transition us into the episode, and we'll find a place to talk about the wonders of John Pertwee later. Maybe when we get to the Maypole scene. But sure. But Roger Delgado's master, Sean. Here's how I want to start.
Okay, yeah.
You have been telling me for years about Roger Delgado's master.
Yep.
And it's not that I didn't believe it; it's that I couldn't conceive of it because I hadn't seen it. And Roger Delgado's master is, simply put, one of the best villains of screen history.
It's like if you,
easily.
If you open up a dictionary and turn to the word villain, it should just be a picture of Roger Delgado as the master in lieu of words. Because it's like, that dude has the perfect look. It is so, to the most minute detail, everything about that dude, villain. Like, it's just the hair, the beard, the sort of scowling face, the, like, sunken in eyes and this heavy brow that casts shadow over his eyes. And, like, they give him the perfect clothes. All the, like, he's always wearing black, except for then this episode he gets to wear his amazing, like, lavish red satanic robes here and there, which are so great. And he's just, the voice is perfect. The attitude is perfect. Like every single, like, the exact ratio of black hair in the beard to white hairs in the beard. Like, it's fucking perfect in a way it is unbelievable.
You couldn't, like, sit down and imagine and animate a better, like, physical villain.
It's like if you fucking found a magic genie and made a wish, the genie couldn't make something as good as Roger fucking Delgado.
No, and, you know, it's so much of it for me, like, in what I've seen, is also that they devoted a whole season to, this is the season where the master will be the antagonist in every story.
Yeah.
To one degree or another. It's like, some he's the full driving force, some less so. But, like, that's a great decision. It means you really get to know him, you get to know his relationship with the Doctor, all these things. And that's one of the things that, like, really got to me watching these in context. And I would stress, if you enjoyed The Demons, if you loved this episode, and if you didn't, who are you?
Yeah.
Watch this season in full. It's just a great fucking season of TV. And there is, like, this light continuity through it of the master keeps fucking with shit. And I love it. And, you know, one of the things that also I think is so real about it is that Roger Delgado and John Pertwee were friends in real life. Good friends. It was actually a component in John Pertwee quitting the show later on was Delgado died in a car crash and just kind of couldn't imagine doing the show without him, which I totally get when you watch this. And that's the great thing is that you can see, like, when, you know, Stephen Moffat wrote all the stuff this year with the Master and the Doctor and how they were friends once, that's, to me, him watching the Roger Delgado, John Pertwee stuff and saying, these guys were totally friends once.
Yeah.
Because that's what you see, is this friendship that has curdled into rivalry, like, more than anything else. I don't think it's like this, you know, the Doctor is like this god figure, like, I must defeat you because you are wrong. It's because I'm better than you. Uh-huh. And there's this, like, petty rivalry between the two of them. But you get this sense of these actors, again, just loving each other in all of these scenes. And they're constantly coming up against the line of, like, why don't we throw all this stupid stuff aside and just go be friends again? And they never do, which is the sad part. Except it's not sad because then you get the satanic ritual. It's amazing.
And it's just, you always get this sense of, like you said, that they used to be friends in some way. And that, like, The Master's kind of having fun, and he's playing. Like, he does, I think he legitimately does want to conquer the Earth and rule over the petty humans, but really it's just like, if the Doctor wasn't there, he wouldn't be on Earth. He wouldn't be sticking around. Like, he wouldn't keep on playing around here if he didn't know that the Doctor was also there, because he wants to have fun, and he comes up with all these ridiculous schemes and is, like, trying to, you know, brainwash people.
That is part of the thing for me about this Master, is that he's not sanctimoniously evil. He's evil for the fun of it.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if you call it evil sometimes. He's just fucking with people.
It's just, you get the sense of, like, he doesn't value life in the way that the Doctor does.
No.
But, like, you know, it's just a different perspective on things for Time Lord.
Like, there's a really defining scene in Colony in Space where the Master's plan involves he wants this space laser that can destroy galaxies.
Yep.
Because, of course.
Very good.
And the Master is, you know, trying to say, like, Doctor, come with me. We could rule and save galaxies together. And it's actually a really interesting, I think, dramatic moment between the two of them. And the Doctor's response is, I don't want to rule the stars, I want to see them. And it's like, that to me is one of the defining Master-Doctor moments, where I think what the Master kind of wants more than anything is to either keep fighting with the Doctor, or for the Doctor to come around and have evil fun with him.
Yeah.
You know, like, he wants a friend in villainy. And it's just all of it. There are so many shadings to this performance. He has so much fun with it. And I think there's something really critical about the show never taking itself too seriously with the Master. Again, like, he's kind of a crappy villain. He's every Master plan is he teams up with some alien race he thinks he can control. He cannot. Things fall apart, and it's up to the Doctor to patch things back together.
Yeah.
For the Master as much as Earth.
Yeah. The other thing I really love about this era of the Master character is also that, like, I feel like because this is when they had to come up with the name and the gimmick and all that stuff, I love his whole thing of that he just tries to psychically dominate people. And so he's just always just like staring into their eyes and saying, you will obey me. And it's just like that, like, he's got the, like, he wants to be the master of people. He wants to have power and authority over them.
And there's a certain vulnerability to that I love, where
yeah.
you see this kind of, again, petty weakness beneath it all, which I think Roger Delgado has a lot of fun playing.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful. He's a great engine for stories in this season, and I presume beyond. I'm interested to see his final set of stories we get later on as I move through this era of the show.
God, when you get to the fucking the Sea Devils, the fucking sword fight is so good. It's so fucking, like, when you're talking about that the Doctor and the Master are actually just playing around and having fun, like, that is the scene I think of as the sword fight scene. You're gonna fucking love it. It's so good.
Like, honestly, if I were, you know, a Doctor Who showrunner today, and I was planning on bringing back the Master again one day, I would look to this model and not have it be like a one-off finale here and there. I'd make him a more regular part of the show.
Yeah.
Which is part of how Michelle Gomez worked so well this last season, is she was a pretty regular presence as Missy throughout the season. And I think,
No
surprise, she became a much more interesting character through that run.
Yeah, I think it's something that it's harder to sell the character when it's too sporadic. Because I think that's even something that classic Doctor Who ran into when it had to move on, is you eventually, you know, they recast the Master a couple of times and then sort of settled on Anthony Ainley playing the role at the end of the Fourth Doctor's run, and then he plays it through to the end, you know, like all the way through to the last story. He's in Survival with Sylvester McCoy. It's like Anthony Ainley is good, but it's also like one, the Roger Delgado performance was so iconic that he couldn't kind of like break out from that. But then also, if you're only having the character appear once a season or once every couple of seasons, he just kind of turns too much into a generic villain and loses that nuance of that relationship with the Doctor that Roger Delgado and John Pertwee just had so naturally, just immediately.
Because it's like, and here's how I want to transition into the Daemons, is, you know, you tell people about the Master today and they're like, all right, you know, he's got his own TARDIS, he's got a laser screwdriver, he tries to conquer Earth, he's got these crazy plans, or she now, you know, because we got a male and a female version. And I'd say, but did you know the Master once shrank people? He once tried to possess the minds of prisoners. He once tried to make a deal with an alien race to, like, take over the Earth. He once basically became a bureaucrat in space to try to fuck over some space miners. And in the culmination of this, he once tried to summon Satan himself to a small English countryside town. Did you know that about the Master?
Oh, I did, because I watched all of these.
Fuck, Sean.
Yes.
The Daemons.
Yes, let's get into it.
It is five perfect episodes of Doctor Who.
Yes, it is one of the, like, very few Doctor Who stories that is five episodes long. And I always forget, I always think it's a six-episode one, and then, like, then I looked at it as, like, oh, wait, no, this is five episodes. That's a weird episode count, but it's a good episode count for this one.
Because it's a weird episode.
It very much is, yes.
It's a weird story. It does take some time ramping up. Like, episodes 1 and 2 is where you get, like, episode 1 is all the stuff that the Master is doing weird incantations in this town, and the Doctor, there's a witch out there who's, like, trying to warn everyone, and the Doctor picks up on this and thinks something's wrong. And then in episode 2, like, these forces were released, but we're not sure what they are. And then at the end, this gargoyle comes to life, and then we're off to the races, where episodes 3, 4, and 5... you keep thinking it can't top itself. You know, episode 3 has the car chase that ends with a helicopter exploding.
Yeah.
Episode 4 has the Maypole scene. And then episode 5 has Azal. Yes. Like, you just think they can't one-up themselves, and they keep doing it, and then drop the mic.
It's just like a succession of larger and larger explosions until you have what is maybe the biggest explosion on screen in the history of Doctor Who.
Where a church just blows up.
The whole fucking church blows up.
And I was reading about this. They did that to a miniature, obviously. But it looked so convincing, and it does when you watch it now, that like people watching it at home were freaked out and wrote the BBC like, you blew up a church, you animals.
Yeah, like that seems a bit excessive for this children's program.
Like it is, they do, you know, the cursory thing that the demons are actually aliens, or as John Pertwee says, daemons from the planet Deimos.
Yeah.
Which is why I called it the Daemons, because I just love that line delivery. Because as with everything Pertwee says, he says it so confidently.
Yeah, he just, like, because it's something that the Doctor learned, like, 500 years ago. So it's like, yeah, he's the Daemon from the planet Deimos. How do you guys not know that?
But other than that, there's not a whole lot of references to them being aliens. This is a story about occult satanic rituals.
Yeah.
And I love that this got on the air on the BBC in 1971.
Uh-huh.
That's yes. Crazy.
Yeah, it's very insane. So let's go to, like, the beginning of the story, because I think I really like episode 1. I really like how they do the slow build-up and the slow setup. Because I think they also, there's a couple of things that they set up, Barry Letts and Robert Sloman in the script. At the very beginning, one of the best things they set up is that the Doctor and Joe are having this conversation where Joe says, as you said earlier, it's like, but it is the Age of Aquarius. And so that like starts this whole conversation with the Doctor about how Joe believes in magic and the supernatural. And the Doctor obviously, I mean, particularly the Third Doctor, he's a man of science, okay? Yeah. Like, he's not the mysticism, blah, whatever. Like, I'm all about the hard science, Joe Grant. And to prove this, he has wired up a remote thing for Bessie, with a like remote control, so that Bessie, his bright yellow like vintage car, is driving around and can honk, and they have a lot of fun showing this car drive around, and the Doctor uses that to try to trick Joe, because Joe, you know, thinks it's probably all magic. It's like, haha, no, it's just a remote control.
Yes. Oh, I mean, we haven't talked about the greatest Third Doctor character yet, Bessie.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Which, I mean, it's one of my favorite just gags in all of Doctor Who is that the Doctor agrees to work with UNIT on the condition they get him a car.
Yeah.
He doesn't want money. He just wants wants space to work on his TARDIS, but he just wants a sick-ass car, because in Spearhead from Space, he steals a hospital director's car, and the Brigadier makes him give it back.
Yeah.
And so he gets this shitty yellow convertible, which becomes like his de facto best friend.
Yes, that has the license plate Who Won that is very good.
Oh, it's great. And Bessie is like a actually surprisingly integral part of many stories.
Yes. But like, none so, like more here, than... they set up this remote control thing that is paid off 2 times later in this 5-part serial.
It's great. I mean, and actually, I was kind of surprised by that, because often the Bessie stuff are kind of one-off gags, which you totally understand.
Yeah.
But like then, and I thought that's what it was in episode 1 here. Like, I thought the thematic thing was more about magic versus science is what we were going to get. But no, Bessie being able to remote control drive herself is all over this thing, making me really want John Pertwee in a Herbie movie. Because he'd be great. Not going to happen, but it'd be cool.
Yes.
Because he's dead. But you know.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's a really good functional scene, because it serves 2 purposes. It serves up this like, you know, supernatural versus science thing, and then it also sets up the Doctor being able to remote control Bessie, which is, spoilers at the very end of the Demons, is the final hand that he plays to capture the Master, who is then the Master is captured for like several stories, because he doesn't come back till the Sea Devils.
Yeah.
It's like he is in prison after this story.
Where I understand they have him on a water prison a la Magneto or
basically,
something.
Basically, yeah. I mean, you gotta deal with the Master in a special way. You can't just throw him in a normal prison.
But yes, oh god, the end of this story is so good.
Yes, but we'll get there.
Oh yeah.
So then after that opening scene, I think the main thing I want to talk about with episode 1 that is like really remarkable, this is something that it stays remarkable for the rest of the show, but it was something I had kind of forgotten about, is the Demons is, for the vast majority of this story, filmed on location in a small English village and is filmed outside. which is really rare for Doctor Who, for classic Doctor Who to have that much outside, like, location filming. The most episodes have a couple, although there are plenty that are just all on studio.
And you do get a little more in the third Doctor because he's on Earth.
Yeah.
But even then, it's obviously not every story.
Yeah, but, like, in particular, what really stood out to me is, like, you almost never see this in classic Doctor Who, is they fucking film at night on location. Like, they go out to this fucking cairn burial, because the whole setup of the plot is that there's this weird, like, hankery professor dude who has some, there's some, like, ancient cairn that he wants to dig up that is actually the, like, tomb of these demon creatures, but he obviously doesn't know that. And you have this witch, Miss Hawthorne, who's also protesting this and doesn't want them to dig up this cairn. But the whole thing is framed as this BBC Three, which at the time BBC Three did not exist. It was supposed to be set in the near future.
That's really funny, because BBC Three, Doctor Who spin-offs have aired on BBC Three.
Exactly, yeah. So at the time, they made up a BBC Three because it was supposed to take place in the near future. And if you want to have, like, a go down a really fun, bizarre rabbit hole, look up, like, unit dating conspiracy on, like, the Doctor Who Wikipedia, and you'll spend a lot of time being like, well, this story was, because of this detail, this story must have been set in the 80s, but that doesn't make sense for all these other reasons. Anyway, so, like, but it's all set up as this BBC Three report of this sort of thing of, like, oh, they're going to open up this burial cairn thing at midnight on, like, May Day or whatever. And I literally like just that setup and a lot of, like, the incidental characters, because that's something that once you're out of episode one, like, once the cairn opens up and the story really starts off, none of that stuff appears again. Like, even they never even really address the fact that that weird professor dude, like, dies once that thing opens up. But I really like all the weird little characters and the weird relationships and interactions on this BBC Three, like, set, and that the framing of the story is really unique, and it allows them to be like, they fucking are filming at night on location, like, and not in a studio. You, like, literally, I can't think of off the top of my head another Doctor Who story that did that. Like, it's just never fucking happened.
Right, and yeah, every episode in this serial does have something different and special about it. I was saying the first two are slower, and I just mean that by they're setting up the plot.
Yeah.
But you do get all these wonderful things. But there are things that carry through. Like, I love that countryside location. They just found such cool places to film. I love the general aesthetic of everything. Like, it very, I mean, it actually reminds me a lot of the other 70s BBC show I know well, which is Monty Python.
Right.
And they love shooting in these kind of places because they thought people there were weird, you know, and So they would do that. And so you get a lot of that. Miss Hawthorne, who totally feels like a character out of Monty Python.
Yeah.
She carries through all five, and she's just a great one-off guest star.
Yeah.
You know, in addition, and that's one of the things is that the Third Doctor stories also have, I think, an unusually high quotient of, like, good guest star characters.
Yeah.
In addition to this great main cast you have. So it's just a very rich ensemble you're always watching. But yeah, that BBC Three thing is interesting because it adds this kind of immediacy to it, and also makes the end of episode one of the better, I think, Doctor Who serial cliffhangers, in that it feels like there's some real consequences to it.
Yeah.
Because most Doctor Who serial cliffhangers are the Doctor, like, turns around, something's about to kill him, and then, like, 5 seconds later it's, oh, thank God, it wasn't what I thought it was, you know?
Right.
Which is fine. It's how they're told. It's fun. But, like, this one is the Doctor goes to try to stop the Professor. The thing blows sky high, just kills the Professor. We never hear from him again. The Doctor is frozen, you know, like an icicle. And this whole town is, like, now has a heat shield around it. It is apocalyptic.
Appropriately so, because it also, like, because it does set the mood very well. This serial has a very, particularly early on, has this very omen-y kind of feeling to it.
Oh, really? Oh, the sets are so much like The Omen.
Yeah, and then, it, like, down to when we get the great reveal of that the Master has replaced this vicar and is wearing, you know, this vicar outfit that already, like, basically looks like what the Master wears anyways. But it's got this really good sense of just, again, like, tension building and of, like, establishing this setting and this mood that then, like, carries through for the whole thing. And I think they do a very good job in this story of making the events feel, like, big and epic and apocalyptic in the appropriate way with, like, a very limited budget and very limited resources in a way that I was, like, I had not rewatched this story since I watched it the first time, which is, like, almost 10 years ago now. And so my memory of some of this stuff was kind of fuzzy. And I was really impressed rewatching it. Like, fuck, they, like, did such a good job with the resources at the time of giving this impression of the fucking, like, this town is just falling apart. Like it is going insane. It's being taken over, basically, by the devil. You have this whole weird cult that is led by the Master. You have this heat shield that has now surrounded the town. And there's just weird shit going on all the time with, like, just whenever Azal the demon appears, just like the screen goes white and red and orange and everything goes shaking and people are falling all over the place. It's like it feels big and dramatic in a way that a lot of classic Doctor Who doesn't really to me.
This frankly feels like the kind of story that modern Who would have to reject for being too ambitious. Because if you did it on a modern scale, you'd want everything to be bigger and scarier and you might say it's too expensive. And it's like there was just something in the imagination here. It was like, no, we'll do it no matter what it takes. And they found ways to be very creative in showing all this stuff. And so much of it is more about, you know, sort of mood and performance than it is any one big special effect they can pull off. But you get so sucked into it. Like, you forget you're watching, you know, a BBC show from the 70s shot on tape and which survives in, you know, this is something we can actually talk about with the Third Doctor. His first two seasons, the surviving versions of the episodes are kind of in this weird state where they did, those were wiped as well. The original color tapes, and what they were restored from were black and white tapes with like a very variety of different sources, but like things that would like give the color information that restoration teams would go in and kind of like a colorization process, but it's restoring the actual color, not giving fake color.
Yeah.
So they're a little rough looking, but yeah, it just all melts away. Even like, you know, there is one, you know, wonderfully crappy effect in these episodes, which is Bok, the gargoyle, who is very clearly a guy in a crappy rubber suit.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, none of it matters, because it's just, you have this heat shield and things are bursting into flames and there's, the world is shaking, and all of those are pretty simple effects for them to do. But man, you just get this sense of like, this is bigger than what the Doctor normally deals with, especially at this point, you know?
And it's something that, again, thinking about, you know, like stepping stones to like becoming what we think of as like modern Doctor Who. I mean, this whole season is the first time they ever sort of experimented with this idea of like, oh, let's have like a kind of recurring element to this one whole season, which is something that classic Doctor Who never stuck with, but does every now and then when it sort of felt like it. So like having the Master recur every single story makes this season feel really special. But then also I think the Demons being the last story like has this proper like season finale kind of feel to it, where like things have gotten ratcheted up to this ridiculous extent. Like it feels like the Earth, like legitimately, like the entire Earth feels like it is legitimately at threat here from Azal, and it does conclude with the capture of the Master. Like it does have, it's not exactly obviously the way that you would do it today, but it is like the rudimentary skeleton of what you think of as a season finale story.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and everyone dances around a maypole.
Exactly.
Because that's, I am sad that in three seasons, Peter Capaldi has not danced around a maypole. Stephen Moffat, how could you?
I mean, you just can't, I mean, they can't do it again because they can't top the original.
Yes, no, you're right. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's apocalyptic, it's big. And again, the like action set pieces they do, like the, when we get to the third, I mean, I don't know when we're going to talk about this, but the third episode has that car chase. It is legitimately a super impressive action scene. It is well shot. It is well choreographed. It's, you know, well conceived more than anything else. But it's exciting where the Doctor's being chased down by this helicopter. He's heading towards a heat shield that will kill him and Joe. Joe and us don't really know what his plan is. And his plan is to drive that helicopter into the heat shield and, like, swing away at the last moment like he's John Rambo or something.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yes. I mean, it's just something that this whole story is very action-packed in a way that was more common for the Third Doctor era, because I think John Pertwee liked to be able to fight things and liked to drive around on the screen and stuff.
What's his karate called? Vesuvian karate?
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, it's Venusian.
Like Venusian.
From Venus.
Okay.
Yes.
Venusian karate. It's so great.
So he doesn't actually use it in this story, but he has a lot of other standout fight scenes. But the big thing that I loved about sort of like the big sequence of fight scenes that sort of recurs a couple of times over the story is Sergeant Benton gets to kick some fucking ass in this story. Like, he gets one like almost every single episode, even if he doesn't win the fight, he gets like a good like meaty fight scene that I was very excited by. It's like, yeah, Sergeant Benton, kick that weird cultist dude's ass.
Well, he kind of teams up with Miss Hawthorne over the course of the story, and they have their little corner of the story, and they keep running into shit. And he just fights it, and Captain Yates feels like the guy who kind of wants attention from his superiors and like to get noticed. Sergeant Benton's like, he'll just take the punches as they come, and he won't even mention it to anyone.
Yeah. I mean, he has this great move that he pulls in that first fight scene where the cultist kind of comes up behind him with a gun drawn, and Sergeant Benton, you know, has his back to him and puts his hands up, and then because the actor's really tall, he just like kicks his leg back and like from behind just kicks from like the bottom of his leg, kicks the gun out of the dude's hand, then turns around and punches him in the face and starts this fight. that is, like, for the time, legitimately, I think, pretty decent fight choreography. If you compare this with something of, like, Star Trek The Original Series, which would have been a little bit earlier, but also Star Trek The Original Series had way more budget and time than the classic Doctor Who did. Like, I was pretty impressed by the action feats of Sergeant Benton. I was like, yeah, this is, I can get behind this. Like, this is a decent little fight scene.
Yeah, I, you know, there's kind of nothing better than late 60s, early 70s TV sci-fi fight choreography.
Yeah.
There's just something great about it. But this is like that cheesy fight choreography done unusually well.
Yeah, there's no like weird, awkward, like double-fisted hits to the back. You're like, that would not hurt anybody. Like, you could do that to a five-year-old child and they'd be like, why are you patting me on the back? And it's like, this looks like, you know, that weird cultist dude straight up just got punched in the face.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate that.
Where do we want to go with the story next?
Another sequence that I really like, sort of like we're kind of talking about a lot of the stuff in episode 2, is near the beginning of episode 2 you have this scene where Sergeant Benton and Mike Yates are in the helicopter together flying over trying to figure out what has happened because they were watching like a football game or something on TV and instead of watching the broadcast of the Cairn being opened, and so they flip to the channel right when the Cairn thing opens up and see like the doctor collapse to the ground and like, well, we should probably be doing something about this.
There is just a tightness to the storytelling here. Like, you reminding me of that detail is, like, that, like, the setup is also that UNIT are all kind of off-duty for the night.
Yeah.
And they don't think anything bad is going to happen, and the doctor is the only one with an inkling that something might go wrong. This is basically, like, these five... And I know we said this about Tomb of the Cybermen, but I feel it, like, even stronger about this one. You could edit these five episodes into a movie, and it would just feel like a great action movie.
Yeah.
And not even, like, a low-budget 70s, like, sci-fi movie. Just, it's an action movie. It's basically Die Hard. It's...
Sure, yeah.
But with, like, the doctor in that role of being stuck in this thing he doesn't expect to be stuck in, and it's all of the, you know, the cops, in this case, UNIT, trying to figure out how to get in or out to help. And all this stuff going on. And it really just does have that kind of propulsive quality where everything is, all the pieces are put into place so that when shit goes wrong, everything is like milked for maximum dramatic potential. Like, yeah. You know, this is not the deepest Doctor Who story. It doesn't have like a bunch of like, you know, deep thematic philosophical things going on, I don't think necessarily. But like, it is so good at what it sets out to do and just basic action, like momentum driven storytelling. Its surfaces are better than most stories' depths.
Yeah. So like, building that momentum and setting some stuff up is that Sergeant Benton and Captain Mike Yates surveil the scene the next morning in a helicopter, which that helicopter comes up a couple of times. They have a lot of fun with that helicopter, because it's not every day that classic Doctor Who gets to use the helicopter, no. So they really use the shit out of this one. But they also, there's this great, like, helicopter shot of them flying over and looking down and seeing there's these gigantic footprints like in the ground, in this like around the small English village, that's almost like the bad Godzilla movie. Like, it's sort of like the shots reminded me of that, of these giant footprints setting up a Zal that we don't like really get as an active presence in the story until the last couple of episodes. But yeah, so they sort of set up that, and it's just in more sort of building that tension, building the sense of like there's something like unusually big going on here. For a Doctor Who story, it's like this giant monster that is somewhere out here, and this is also sort of where we get what we talked about with Sergeant Benton and Miss Hawthorne teaming up and suggesting this slight romance between them that I wish went somewhere. Like, I wish I like there has got to be some weird like Doctor Who magazine comic or Big Finish audio story that is about like the married life of Sergeant Benton and Miss Hawthorne together after the, like 10 years after the story took place.
Oh, and I seriously doubt there's anything in the rest of classic Doctor Who that would prevent you from having that be your headcanon.
Sure, yeah,
that's who he goes home to.
I mean, it's got to be. They have such a good relationship because Miss Hawthorne is so weird and crazy, and you know Sergeant Benton is so like down to earth and stable. They balance each other well.
Miss Hawthorne is one of the most unique versions of this like archetypal character I've ever seen, in that she's never really the butt of the joke.
Uh-huh.
She's usually in on the joke. She knows people think she's weird. At some point, I think she even knows she's wrong about this specific incident, and she doesn't care. She just does her.
Yeah, like it's the thing with Miss Hawthorne that I really like about her character is that she obviously, most of the town thinks that she's like the crazy mad woman that lives like on the hill or something, and she's fully cognizant of that, is 100% aware, is in no way ignorant that that is how she's perceived, but she doesn't give a fuck because, like, she's trying to help people. She's a white witch. She's trying to save lives here. And so she's going to do whatever it takes to do that. And I really like that small detail of her character, that she carries herself with pride.
So in the second slash third episode is also where we start learning about the heat shield around the town. Yeah. This is one of my favorite details, because it provides a lot of the action, is that kind of the ticking clock in this one is, can UNIT and the Brigadier get through the heat shield in time to help the Doctor? Yeah. And the Doctor has these wonderful interactions with a UNIT scientist who is not very good at his job.
Who is named Osgood.
Which is real. I that was interesting.
Yeah. I had forgotten that that was a reference to a small... Yeah. I mean, he's only in this story, so...
Yes.
It's not... Osgood's not around a lot, but...
Well, because I was actually meant to ask you that. Is Osgood a bigger thing? Because they went so far as to name a character after him later.
No, but no. I think probably Steve Moffat just thought it was a good name. And was like, well, it makes a good, decent little weird reference too.
Yeah, no, totally. That's one of Stephen Moffat's favorite things to do.
Yeah.
His little weird references. But yes. You have Osgood and them trying to get through. But I think the whole idea, because it's... this great idea where it obviously doesn't take a lot of money to realize that idea. You just have to, like, light things on fire at opportune moments. But it really does give this sense of, like, there's a physicality to it. Almost like today the thing would be like there's a dome around the city.
Right.
Like Stephen King style. But they don't need that, because there's just the idea of this heat shield. And that's just and it leads to so many cool things over the course of the episode. And I think a pretty legitimately impressive special effect when they get through it. And there's like this kind of tunnel ring they can go through. I don't know how they pulled that off.
I can actually tell you how they pulled that off, because there was a small, like, I guess like an hour long sort of like documentary thing they made for, I think it was like originally a VHS release. You can find it online. It's John Pertwee, Nicholas Courtney, the actors who play Captain Mike Yates, and Sergeant Benton, the director for this episode. Actually, just find his name, because he's very good. And the director also has directed a number of different Doctor Who stories that we maybe will see another episode from him sometime in the near future, is Christopher Barry.
Right.
And so for this feature called, I think, At Devil's End, there's a lot of, they kind of, Nicholas Briggs takes them up to this town and like sort of like is interviewing them and talking to them about all this stuff and sort of like reminiscing about this story. And then Christopher Barry talks about that special effect. What they did was they sort of made this like little like arc thing and put this like glimmery sort of like Christmas glitter stuff on it, and then put the camera behind a plastic like glass sheet and put Vaseline on that sheet around where you would see through to this like weird little arc they made with the glittery stuff on it, and so shot it through that with that Vaseline to make it look very like vague and kind of sparkly.
See, this is why CGI is destroying us. You don't have to get this creative. I love that. I love that someone figured that out, because it is 100% an impressive special effect.
I think everything around the special effects with the heat shield are like, some of them are not as like sort of like creative, like technically creative as that specific one, but they're all really effective.
Yeah, totally.
And it lends that side, because that's the sort of the Brigadier side of the story is him, you know, because again, he was out of town. I think the implication was like he was basically on a date or something. And then he's trying to figure out what happens, finds out that Sergeant Benton and Mike Yates have taken his helicopter and are flying around, and he's like, okay, I need to figure out what the fuck's going on here, and goes up to where the seat shielded thing is, where also, this is where we get one of the first explosions in the demons, is some random, like, delivery dude or something, like, actually, like, is driving into the heat shield and gets out of his car for some reason, and the car just fucking explodes, which is very good.
Like, they also, in addition to getting their hands on a helicopter, they got their hands on some dynamite, and they had a lot of fun with it.
It was just, like, it was left over from some, like, movie production or something, so, like, well, let's just blow up this fucking truck. So anyways, the heat shield thing, I think, is a really good combination of, one, like, just having, like, them, like, spread all this, like, this big line of, like, soot or black, like, dust, whatever it is that they put down there to make it look like this is, like, this impassable area. The heat shield, they have this, like, sound effect that goes along with it that kind of, like, sounds like rushing wind. And then they just really love sticking shit into the heat shield and having it explode. And then also, and they kind of use that effect again to demonstrate Bok's powers when they're, like, throw a rock at him and they have it blow up, the rock blow up in midair and, like, kind of vaporize. And it's a really simple effect, but it's particularly that first time they do it when the Brigadier like cautiously steps up to the heat shield and takes out his like riding crop thingy and sticks it in there, and the end of it just bursts into flames. And it's one of those things of like, you know, they actually just like burst the end of that thing into flames while Nicholas Courtney was holding it, so you can see the expression on his face is like, holy shit! Like, you don't even need to act for that one, because it's got to be surprising when anything you're holding just explodes into flames in your hand. And every time they're like, they throw rocks, they throw sticks, they throw all this shit and just blow it up when it goes through the heat shield. And it's a really simple but very convincing effect of, you do not want to pass through this big black zone because you will fucking die.
Yeah. And it just, again, in that kind of die hard way, it adds so much like immediate tension to so many things, because there is this kind of ticking clock. Will they be able to get through that heat shield?
Yeah.
In time. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, we talked about the car chase. The car chase is amazing.
Yeah, it's just, again, they get to make very good use of this helicopter by having the helicopter swooping down on the doctor while he's driving with Bessie. And then they make use of the stock footage of the helicopter blowing up. So you get another giant explosion.
Which, I will say, it's all well integrated. If I had not read that, I wouldn't have.
Yeah, me neither. Like, I think I could have guessed that, like, they probably didn't do that, because I think, like, right. That would have been very hard, like, for classic Doctor Who to do, like, even like on miniatures, that wouldn't right. be easy to do. But it's a very good effect. It's just a good, like, ramping up.
It's also a nice reminder that, like, James Bond was relatively fresh enough at the time that they could license footage from it.
Exactly.
You could never do that today.
Yeah. And that would be pretty amazing if, like, fucking for the Christmas special, Stephen Moffat got fucking stock footage from Skyfall.
Yes, that'd be... I don't know where it would even go, but they do it, like the house blowing up at the end.
Exactly, yeah. But that also, that sequence leads to another detail I really like, is that for a lot of this episode, Captain Mike Yates has been driving around on this motorcycle, and he's on that motorcycle
right?
during this helicopter chase where he's started futilely shooting his pistol at it, and then after that, I forget like the whole sequence of why the doctor transfers over, but then the doctor is like, here, let me take this motorcycle, gets on the motorcycle, and this is a thing that you might not know about, like, John Pertwee, was that he was a total motorhead. I think it's one of the reasons why he liked having all these weird vehicles. He also was a big fan of motorbikes.
Of course,
so
he was.
He gets on, like, fucking John Pertwee gets on this motorbike and just revs the thing up and drives off. It's like... is a man who was made to be on a fucking motorcycle.
It's amazing, because I don't think we've had another Doctor Who actor who has been that confident getting on a motorbike.
Yeah, it's just, and it's something, his costume is so perfect to it too, because he's got the whole cloak that is like flapping in the winds. It's another on that At Devil's End mini documentary. There's a funny little thing that they talk about, that apparently John Pertwee and the director Christopher Barry were having an argument the day that they were filming all the motorcycle stuff, and John Pertwee kind of got bored with filming, so he just drove off and went for a small Sunday ride
around the
English countryside on this motorcycle.
He just was the Third Doctor. That's exactly what the Third Doctor would do.
Uh-huh. It's very funny. It's a really good mental image of just be like, I'm just gonna...
Okay, that's a good enough segue. Sean, why is John Pertwee an amazing doctor?
Oh, man. I mean, there's so much he brought to the role. I think, like, and one of the big things is this transition to this, like, really competent, like, powerful leading man figure that the Doctor... sort of never really was before this point. That the First Doctor definitely has this, like, confidence, but he's also old and kind of frail in that way, that, like, he's not physically imposing all the time. And then the Second Doctor is so sort of, like, bouncing around the edges of all these confrontations, trying to sort of push things, because he's also not, like, physically powerful. Whereas, like, John Pertwee has this, like, intense charisma and physical presence on screen. He was this, like, really tall, like, fit guy. He was also in the military. He was in the Navy. So, like, he has that whole presence. Although one of the funny things about it is that he was really famous before Doctor Who for playing the main character in Wurzel Gummidge, which was a children's comedy program where he played this, like, sentient scarecrow kind of character. So he was known for being a comedian and sort of, like, a comic actor before this point. But he just, like, comes on the screen immediately as the Third Doctor, totally commanding, takes control of every single, like, moment that he's on screen, utterly commands his screen presence constantly, and also just has this really fun, interesting interpretation of the character, which is leaning more into this, like, I know best. I am smarter than all of you. I know everything about all this shit. Like, I'm a man of science. And they give John Pertwee a lot of gobbledygook to say in all these stories. He gave, another reason why The Demons is a great one to pick for John Pertwee is that he does tell Osgood to reverse the polarity flow. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about? But it is he's got that commanding presence on screen, but then also is able to be very warm. And that's one of the things I like about his relationship with his, like, main companions in particular, is he has that kind of, like, father-daughter relationship with them, and is this very warm, like, kind figure, and you feel... And it's one thing I feel like... I think this is something that Peter Capaldi said in an interview, is that whenever he was on screen, you felt utterly safe. Like, just something that you know he's going to take care of this, then you are utterly safe with him 100% of the time.
I love that description. I mean, I love pretty much anything Peter Capaldi says about Doctor Who, because few people are more of an authority, you know, especially now having played the Doctor for 4 years. But it's, I agree. All of that, absolutely. And beyond that, like, one of the things that's so fun about this era is that I think the stories and the status quo are all written so well to Jon Pertwee's strengths, in that, you know, putting the Doctor in the scenario where he is trapped on Earth brings out both the best in the Doctor and sometimes the most petty, because his, like, singular goal is to get away from these stupid humans.
Yeah.
And he, like, it kind of brings out the snob in him, and that he just wants, because he cannot go out and, like, save the universe willy-nilly, he has to get, like, love and affection from all these people around him, and so he's a show-off.
Yeah.
And he's kind of a prick about it, you know? But such a lovable one. Like, he never means ill. He's just kind of smug. And, you know, he's earned it. He's an immortal Time Lord. He's earned it a little bit. But that's so fun, and I think it leads to some interesting stories also about his ego. And the demons isn't quite one of those, but I think there are other ones in the run. Like, Inferno is completely, the Doctor goes too far and makes a huge mistake with his TARDIS, and he's too eager to get away, and he nearly, like, I mean, he winds up saving the Earth, but a lot of stuff goes wrong before the end, and it's about him kind of overcoming that. And I do think they allow the Doctor to have all these different interesting kind of shadings and character flaws that make him really interesting, but it does come back to me to that warmth and intelligence. And I love that Peter Capaldi description, that you always feel safe when he's on screen. There's just, I could watch Jon Pertwee's Doctor read the phone book. He is so entertaining all of the time. He is such a confident, commanding, warm, wonderful presence. You know, I've said this before, and, like, really watching through it in order solidifies it for me. He's my favorite Doctor, him or probably Peter Capaldi, which I know is weird because he's still technically the Doctor, but I can say that. He's really good.
Sure, yeah.
But, like, you know, those are kind of the two. If I pick one classic and one modern is what I was going to say. Those are kind of the two that come to mind for me. And just, again, that's why I wanted to watch this run, is every time I'd watch a Jon Pertwee story, it was like, I need to see more of this. And it is something where, when you watch it in order, you just get so much more of what that performance is, and how much there is, I think, going on in it. He's wonderful. And it also, like, I love the detail that he was a comedian before he was the Doctor.
Yeah.
Because it's not like an overtly comic performance all the time, but I do think you get this a lot when comedians go dramatic, is that they're able to bring, frankly, even more shadings than a dramatic actor would be able to find some of the time, you know? And it's interesting, because we have not had, like, a straight comedian play the Doctor in the modern era. Many of them are very funny, but this is kind of a unique thing.
Yeah. Another element of the Third Doctor that I love is the costume. Oh, the costume is so good. Because this is also the first time the show goes for a more outlandish costume, because for the First Doctor and the Second Doctor, it's just kind of like fairly normal, like dressed up men's clothes that have like a little bit of eccentricity to it, but not a whole lot. Whereas like the Third Doctor just goes all the fucking way with it, and man, does Jon Pertwee look really fucking amazing in those outfits.
Oh, he looks amazing. Like, and it's a great, like, revolving door of costumes, too, because he's got the same kind of undershirt with, like, all the frills and everything that looks like he's from an 1800s wig party or something, but, like, the outer coat there's different colors. Like, in this one, in episode 3, he has this red one that is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Maybe kind of reminded me of the 12th Doctor. I think it's in Pyramid at the End of the World. He has that red coat.
Sure, yeah.
It really feels like a Jon Pertwee costume when you get there. But, like, and he has, like, the color under, like, the cape he wears and everything. Like, obviously so much of it was built around Doctor Who's in color now. Let's use, like, and actually it's something I think is actually very impressive on a production standpoint in the Jon Pertwee years, is that they didn't just switch to color and not think about it. They find a lot of creative ways to use color in the stories. Like, the Daemons is one that I can't imagine in black and white.
Oh, yeah.
Just like Tomb of the Cybermen, I can't imagine in color. This is one I can't imagine without the color. It's so vibrant and important to everything that happens. And yeah, I always love when he gets a new color for the coat. It looks so cool.
Yeah. I was Jon Pertwee in an interview that he gave back when he was Doctor Who, talked about with, like, because he obviously had a lot of input into the costume, and he said one of the reasons why he liked the cloak is that for him, symbolically, it was like the wings of a mother hen, that it is like that he would drape around someone to, like, protect them, which is very much how he kind of uses it. It's a great...
He does do that, and, you know, he has this, you know, the physicality he has with people, like with Joe Grant especially. You probably wouldn't do that with a Doctor today, where he's frequently, like, you know, putting an arm around her, kissing her forehead or something. It doesn't play weird to me, though. Like, it is so father-daughter. This is so far before the Doctor Who had an inkling of, we're going to give the Doctor a young woman to fuck in space.
Right, yes,
you know,
yeah.
Like, that's not the story. And it is just this affectionate, you know, fatherly, grandfatherly kind of thing. And it's just, it's sweet more than anything. He's a very, he likes to hide it, I think, under a lot of maybe, not bluster, but again, pride.
Yeah.
But he does care very deeply, I think, about the people around him.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is so much fun. Like, again, one of the reasons I would recommend the story right before this, Colony in Space, which I think is a little underknown, is there's a lot of good... That's the first one where he gets to go into space in the TARDIS.
Yeah.
And Joe Grant as well. And you get to see, like, a different side of the Third Doctor where, like, he's not in active control of the situation all the time. And kind of how he reacts to some of those things. Because it's kind of the first time he has to truly panic about a companion, I feel like.
Right.
Anyway. But that leads me into Episode 4.
Yes.
Which is where... The Doctor, the Master's minions, who are the people in the town who have been kind of hypnotized, brainwashed by... Because we forgot to say the Master is a master of hypnosis also.
Yes, exactly. Because this, again, this is when they start playing around with this idea that Time Lords have, like, latent, small psychic abilities. And that the Doctor just tends to not use them, but the Master has no qualms in trying to mentally dominate people.
Yep, and he has mentally dominated the people of this town. Although it's never clear if he literally hypnotized them or just he gave some really impressive speeches.
I mean, you do have that really fantastic scene where he's like holding this sort of like small town hall and just telling all these people like you can have everything you want. All you have to do is obey me. And then, like, eventually, like, the townspeople are like, no, we're not. It's like, you fools! You think you're going to rule the world? I'm going to rule the world! And it's like, and he's just like, he drops all the pretense. He's just like, no, you're just going to obey me. Like, he stops trying to just convince them. He's like, you primitives, fuck off. No.
Every scene with the Master in this story is solid gold.
Yeah.
But you get this one where the people in the town have decided the Doctor is a wizard. Or a dark, you know, witch, and has to be burned. So they tie him to the maypole, which they have been dancing around, and are starting to burn him. And Miss Hawthorne comes out and convinces them that the Doctor is a great, like, white wizard named Kwee Kwai Quad.
Yeah. Well, you missed, like, the build-up to that scene is also fucking perfect. Because, like, Sergeant Benton and Miss Hawthorne are, like, hiding in the bar, basically, at the tavern. And the Doctor has just gone off and sort of, like, helped the Brigadier set up all his stuff with Osgood. So he's on the way back from that and is walking up across this sort of like this village green area in the middle of the village where all the people are now holding this May Day festival where they're running around the maypole with the thing and there's the one dude with the whole weird like leaf get up or whatever it is. And so the Doctor's walking up to the tavern. Sergeant Benton sees him and is like, look, it's the Doctor. And then while the Doctor's coming up, all the people dancing around the maypole like get in front of him and are kind of like pushing him into the middle. And then eventually they just surround him and Sergeant Benton cut to Sergeant Benton. He said, that doesn't look right. And then you just see the dude with the weird outfit. You find out it's like the main cultist guy pulls a fucking gun on him and then they tie him around the maypole. It's like such an absurd sequence of events, but it's very good.
It's so good. And again, it's like they know John Pertwee can very nimbly move between the action, the drama, and the comedy.
Yeah.
And his, like, reactions through this are so great. And then it's Miss Hawthorne to save the day. And I love that the Doctor has to basically realize, oh, shit, she has a really good idea here. I have to play along with this. And it's so funny.
Yeah.
Because he's like, I will do miracles. Look at that light. I will explode it. And it explodes.
I command you, lamp. Explode! And then Sergeant Benton with a silenced pistol shoots the lamp and everyone goes, oh!
Maybe Sergeant Benton's best contribution to this is that he's in on it too. Like, he just figures out, like, yep, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
And it's great. Like, I love that the Doctor has enough of a working relationship with these people that they're in on ludicrous plans like this.
Yeah.
And he blows, and he hits, like, this rooster thing.
The weather vane.
Yeah, the weather vane. And then it's, car, move!
You come to me!
And Bessie moves. And it's great.
And because that's where because when he gets Bessie to move, that's when the cultist dude is just like, no! Because everyone else has been convinced by this lamp exploding and the fucking weather vane turning, which is also, by the way, like, weather vanes are supposed to fucking turn. Like, yeah, it's impressive that it turned right around the time that he said, weather vane, move! But also that just means the wind blew. Like, it's not the most amazing miracle ever committed, you know, by man. But all these villagers are like, he's real, it's Kwee Kwai Kwad or whatever. And then this one guy's like, no, don't listen to him, he's lying to you. And then the Doctor says, well, fine, if you won't believe me, look behind you. He says, I'm not going to listen to you, the traitor. And he says, Car, I command you, come to me. And so then Bessie very slowly turns and pulls up, and the guy pulling the gun refuses to look behind him because he thinks he's going to be tricked. And so Bessie just very slowly pushes him over, and he falls on the ground.
It's such a great sight gag. I mean, it really is like something out of a Herbie movie.
Yeah, it's very good. And then when that guy, another thing I really love is when that guy gets up and he's trying to escape, Sergeant Benton runs out, like jumps off of the side of Bessie and tackles the guy to the ground, which is a great little stunt that he pulls. That's again, because another element of Sergeant Benton that I think one of the reasons why I really love his presence in this story is that he's not in uniform.
Yeah.
He's just wearing this really dope leather jacket and like jeans. And so it's Sergeant Benton off duty. It's like if you had a Sergeant Benton movie where like he had to like, you know, he went so off the rails that he had to turn in his gun and his badge in, but he's still going after the guy. That's what he looks like.
What are the chances that's a Big Finish story that exists right now?
I really hope it does. I'll have to go look for that on their website. But
there's a non-zero chance that
I mean, he has been in Big Finish stories, so there's actually a non-zero chance that they have just full-on done that. But yeah, that little thing where he just, it's that little detail where he jumps off of Bessie to get that like extra momentum to tackle the guy to the ground.
And then we reach the climax of the story where Joe Grant has, there's this whole thing where Joe Grant gets like knocked out and all this stuff happens. And then
yeah, Captain Mike Yates is trying to save her, but yeah. Can't.
And she wakes up and decides she's going to go try to stop all this. It's almost like she's possessed or something.
Yeah.
We don't get a like clear explanation for it, but it's cool. And then she and Mike Yates are in the temple where the Master is doing his third summoning of Azal. And we haven't even talked about all the Master scenes yet. But like this whole, because as his plan comes into being, he wants Azal to grant him his power. And the Master keeps that, like, Azal will be summoned three times, and on the third time he will make his choice. And so the Master keeps doing these rituals. And I mean, are there many Doctor Who moments better than Roger Delgado as the Master speaking in satanic tongues on an altar?
It's with the robe. Like, the robe is so good. And then later in, like, the third summoning, he has, like, this, like, sacrificial knife thing that he pulls out to. And it's just, again, Roger Delgado has the perfect fucking look. Either for the Master or for like the head of a satanic cult. Turns out that those are pretty equivalent character roles.
And I just love like you get, because he always has like more, you know, satanic gobbledygook to say. And it's like the Master did his homework. Like he really got into this. He got the clothes. He got the knife. You kind of do get a feeling once in a while that the Master just, he likes to play the villain, like play dress up and like do something like this. And you get that here.
He's pulling heavily from his goth phase back on Gallifrey.
Yes. And, but yeah, we get the third summoning of Azal. He's going to sacrifice Joe Grant to the demon god. The Doctor, there's so much good action in the last episode where they are able to get through the heat shield, but then like the device breaks down on the way through, and so the Doctor isn't able to stop Bok, so he has to run around Bok, the goblin demon thing, or the gargoyle. Yeah. And the Doctor gets in there, fully expecting that he might get killed by this thing. And you have this final standoff where the Master, Azal, and the Doctor are all shouting. And it's like thunderous. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and you get this really great line where the Master is like, the stuff is like, no, like, let me, like, I will have the power and I will rule these people. And then it's like, you know, I'm the one who's fit to rule all these people. And then the Doctor just sort of says off to the side to Joe, I think I've heard someone talk like that before. I think it was Hitler. Or was it Genghis Khan? Which is a really good little, it's a very John Pertwee line.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, there's so much good stuff that happens in this scene. I love that Azal just completely friend zones the Master and is like, I will give my power, but not to you. And he decides to give it to the Doctor. The Doctor rejects it. And then what saves the day is Joe Grant and the power of love.
Exactly, yes. She jumps in front of the Doctor and says, no, he's a good, kind man. And it's like, you can't kill him. And then Azal can't understand like the contradiction of how illogical and insane this choice is. Because also Azal, There's all this stuff about how he is summoned through, like, negative emotions and all this stuff, and that the ritual is done, you know, to sort of generate these negative emotions and then have some quality that, can, like, controls an Azal in some way. It's a lot of, like, weird stuff, but I really like the little, like, the detail they try to give it. And so, yeah, I think that is the one area of the episode that feels slightly weak is that, like, how they defeat Azal at the end is like, you just had to do something to get rid of him. But what makes up for it is the whole action sequence that is happening outside while the Doctor is doing all this is that UNIT has come all the way through and they are, like, posted up outside this church where Bok, the, like, invincible gargoyle who's powered by the magic of Azol, or, I'm sorry, the science of Azol, I should say, is standing in front of, like, this gate. And so all the UNIT people are standing there and they're trying to shoot him and doesn't do anything. This is where the Brigadier rolls up, and finally, like, the Brigadier is able to sort of, like, be in the episode with the rest of the people to kind of, like, finally be able to crack this problem. And so I think he's, like, talking to Sergeant Benton. It's like, he can't, it's that Bok, like, we can't get that guy. And it's like, well, I'll have him soon sorted. Jenkins! Chap with the wings, 5 rounds rapid, and a legend was born.
And I cheered, grabbed the remote, rewound, and watched it like 3 more times.
Yeah.
Because that is one of the more infamous Doctor Who lines. So much so that Nicholas Courtney titled his memoir, 5 Rounds Rapid.
Yeah.
It's so tied to him. Yeah, chap with the wings there. Yeah, chap. 5 Rounds Rapid. It is an all-time moment.
It's a fantastic line. Unfortunately, shooting Bok 5 times with an assault rifle doesn't really do much to him. So they have this whole huge standoff where they're like they just have all these extras playing unit dudes that are just like hiding behind like gravestones shooting at Bok. And then eventually, I think Captain Mike Gates says something that's like, it's like shooting 4-inch armor plating with a pea shooter. Benton, go get that bazooka over there. And fucking Benton goes, gets a bazooka, comes over with this fucking bazooka, which is the most amazing thing in the world to see in Doctor Who. And Benton shoots fucking Bok with his bazooka, and Bok explodes all over the place. Eventually, he reforms. Like, in this, what is also, actually, I think, a pretty good special effect of Bok coming back together.
So they just rewind the footage, but it looks really cool.
It looks, it's a very good look. But just the image of fucking Sergeant Benton walking up with a fucking rocket launcher and firing it is so amazing. That is, again, like the 5th giant explosion we've had in this episode. That it's not even the last one yet.
And it all comes together so great. Because I know the Joe Grant Power of Love thing is a deus ex machina, but it's also like with who those characters are and everything that's happened, it just works for me. Yeah. Like, you just go with it.
I think it definitely like works even better in context with like the rest of the season when like you've been building up these relationships.
Absolutely. And you get that, and then that allows them to blow up Bok for good, and just everything, like, it all comes together and you just want to cheer. And they go outside and they decide, you know, maybe there is some magic in the world, and dance around the maypole together. And not just Joe. Oh no, John Pertwee, of course he joins in.
Yes. But before that, we have to talk about the biggest explosion. I mean, we can sort of talk
about
where the church explodes. But one of my favorite parts is before the church explodes is everybody is running out. And I love that, like, because everyone's like, oh God, this thing is going to explode. It's all the cultists and the unit people and the doctor and Joe and the master are all just mixed in together. And they're all just running for their fucking lives. And there's this great little sort of like gaffe that happens, but it's like a really good, like, it works because the two extras pull it off, is that one of the cultists that are running out of the church trips over another one and falls on the ground and has to scramble to get back up. It's very funny, but it works really well.
Yeah, no, it gives the right kind of, like, chaos.
Yeah.
And then, like, the church explosion is legitimately impressive. Like, that's good miniature work.
Yeah.
It's awesome. This great big, you know, what is a great action story without a final explosion to punctuate things? And then they capture the master. The master gets away in Bessie, and then the doctor says, they're like, oh, we've lost the master again. Not so fast. And he pulls out his little remote control and brings Bessie back. And you see the master like, oh, fuck.
I also love the way that the master is, because they've captured the master, and like Sergeant Benton has him at gunpoint. And the master just flips his cloak over Sergeant Benton, and Sergeant Benton just collapses to the ground like he's like a newborn fawn or something. He can't stand up when he can't see. So then the master runs away and gets at Bessie.
It's such a perfect ending, as you say, not just this story, but this whole season, because it does feel like a lot is kind of converging here. Not as much as we would say in like a modern setting, but like certainly for this, it feels actually very progressive as a piece of storytelling for TV at the time. And yeah, and then we get the Maypole dance, and I wanted to stand up and cheer. This is a hell of a story.
It's really fucking good.
I mean, so John Pertwee, on multiple occasions, called this his favorite Doctor Who story.
Yeah.
The director of this episode, who went on to direct a lot more Doctor Who, always said this was his favorite. I think multiple people on the production staff would say that. It's often cited as one of the great Doctor Who stories. And, you know, people just, it has a legacy. and it deserves every fucking inch of it. I think there are maybe Doctor Who episodes as good as this one. I don't know if there's many that are better than this one. This is as good as it gets.
Especially, if you're looking for this sort of, exciting action kind of Doctor Who story, which isn't that common, but it happens more frequently now. And it's one of the things that makes this story feel, almost weirdly, ahead of its time in a way. I mean, not ahead of its time in the way that it wasn't appreciated when it came out, because it certainly was. But in terms of, the kind of Doctor Who story, it feels kind of like what Moffat liked to do a little bit with, particularly in the Matt Smith era of, think of, the Pandora opens and the Big Bang of, these really big, spectacular, kind of action stories almost with a science fiction-y kind of, element or veneer to it. And this really has that quality to it. And it's executed so phenomenally.
It's so good. It's so good. And here's the thing, though. I've watched 2 seasons of The Third Doctor. This is probably my favorite of the ones I've seen. But there is Inferno.
Yeah.
And there is Spearhead from Space. And there's so many good ones. It's hit after hit after hit. And I haven't even gotten to his first Dalek episode.
That's true. I'm not sure if you're going to be super blown away by it, but...
Okay. I've read about the plot, and it seems cool, so...
I really like the Ogrons, and the Ogrons are very cool.
Yeah, just moving on a bit, I'll say, I am going to continue with my Third Doctor rewatch. Depending on what you say the Fourth Doctor story is, we'll decide if I have to skip ahead a little bit at first. But I'm delayed a moment here, because the service I've been using to watch Doctor Who is BritBox. Right. Which is a great service. There are some episodes they don't have the rights to. The next one after this, Day of the Daleks, they don't have.
I don't think they
have many of... some of the Dalek episodes they don't have. And I don't know what the rights issues are for that. It might just be the BBC is like, they sell too many DVDs. So I was able to find a DVD of this and get it. And as soon as that comes, I will resume my rewatch. But I got that. And I did go ahead and find which other ones are missing. And it's really just the other Dalek one.
All right.
I've gotten a couple of those on DVD. Because here's this little life hack for Doctor Who fans. If you do want to collect any Classic Who on DVD, do not buy the American versions. They're way overpriced. And most of them are out of print and had very limited print runs here. The UK ones you can get super cheap on eBay and elsewhere. I was getting these for $10 a pop, which is kind of nothing for some of these.
Yeah.
And they're really cool. So just get a region-free player and you're good to go. They're all the same stuff. But yeah, anyway, BritBox is, I should say, as we're going through this, it's a really good service, $6 a month, and if you want to watch Classic Who with us, all the ones Sean's been recommending are on there.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. It's a very easy way. It's like, when we've talked about Classic Who in the past, there was no easy place to go point people to.
Yeah.
These stories.
It was it would sometimes jump around, and sometimes Netflix would have some, Hulu had some for a while, Amazon had some for a while, but it was never stable in a streaming capacity. Which is always very frustrating.
So, Sean.
Yes.
We will next month resume and we will move on to the Fourth Doctor, Tom Baker, who has by far the longest tenure of any Doctor.
He does.
So, what are our plans for next month?
So what we're going to do, I also want to point out something of that I have decided. We're going to do 2 Fourth Doctor ones because his run is 7 years long, which is, the John Pertwee had the second longest run with 5 years, which is already very long, but 7 years is long enough that I just could not pick one story that I was this is the Fourth Doctor. This is the Fourth Doctor story that represents his era. So we're going to split it in half. We're going to do a late era Fourth Doctor one 2 months from now. But next month, I have deliberated significantly over which one to pick because I think for me personally, the first 3 seasons or so of the Fourth Doctor is maybe to me the most creatively powerful section in the history of the show. And there are a lot of really brilliant episodes to pull from. I played with maybe doing Ark in Space, and I was Ark in Space is really fucking good. I've also seen Ark in Space 4 times, so I was we're not going to do Ark in Space. People should watch Ark in Space. But also, Jonathan, I want you to wait and see Ark in Space in context on top of it, because I think it's when you see that go from Robot, which is Fourth Doctor, which is Tom Baker's first story, to Ark in Space, it's a really interesting transition. So we're not going to do Ark in Space because I thought about that for a while. Then I was maybe we'll do Pyramids of Mars. Pyramids of Mars is a really good story. And I was leaning on that one for a while. But then I was you know what? In my heart of hearts, if I'm looking at these stories, and I obviously can't do Talons of Wang Chiang because we've already done that. And even that's not quite the gothic horror one I want because this is the gothic horror era of Doctor Who. If I'm going with my gut, I have to do the story that is based on the best gothic horror novel that exists, Frankenstein. So we're going to do The Brain of Morbius.
Okay. Next
month for the Fourth Doctor.
Unexpected left field choice.
It's really fucking good. I'm really excited. It is going to be our first story that is basically co-written by Robert Holmes, who is my favorite writer in the history of Doctor Who. And also, if you're a big fan of modern Doctor Who and you've always wondered where the fuck did all those weird old women in the red robes come from in the fucking Peter Capaldi stuff, well, now you're going to find out.
Indeed. So next month, the brain?
The brains of Morbius. It's very good.
Will we have jelly beans?
I think there might be a couple of jelly babies waiting for us.